Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s. It works for members like...
I'm Haley, and I've lost 100 pounds. Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects. It's all in one place.
Weight Watchers handles the insurance for you and offers affordable cash pay options. With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
I'm Mike, and I've lost 135 pounds. Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
I'm Sharia, and I lost 80 pounds on Weight Watchers. I realized that it would take more than a prescription to lose weight and feel good on a GLP-1.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last.
I can't imagine doing a GLP-1 without Weight Watchers.
Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com/GLP-1. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now, it's your turn. Weight Watchers, watch it work.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Grey Malkin Lane podcast, where queer friends and allies gather to review and discuss the original X-Men comics in continuity order. We're recording this in December, but this episode's going to be debuting in mid-February. It is 2026. Who knows what is going on in the world? But as always, we are giving ourselves permission to just be silly, fun, and nerds and talk about lovely things. And so that's what we are here to do today. I'm so happy to be having two of my very favorite people, the incredible Stephanie Williams and the wonderful Marewa Ayodele, are here with me. We're going to be reviewing Marvel Team-Up Annual Number 1, which is from December 1976, right in the early Claremont era, where the characters in the X-Men are still kind of brand new, and they are here for kind of an epic story with Spider-Man. Let me have you both introduce yourselves very briefly, tell us about yourselves, your pronouns, tell us a little about what you're working on these days. Let's begin with Marewa. Hi, welcome back to Grey Malkin Lane, my friend.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's always fun to be here. My name is Marewa Ayodele, he, him, current writer of the Rogue Storm and Storm Earth's Mightiest Mutants.
And also welcome the lovely Stephanie Williams. Hi, Stephanie. It was so lovely to see you in New York a few weeks ago. Well, a few months ago now, I guess.
It feels like yesterday, but I'm happy to be here. So again, Stephanie Williams, she, her, and currently I am working on Roots of Madness and Temporal, but I'm working on obviously other stuff that hopefully will be announced around the time this comes out. Wonder Woman 29 and 30.
Stephanie's sitting in front of this adorable like burning room backdrop, but you keep leaning forward and the chair behind you, it makes it look like the Grim Reapers like coming in slowly behind you each time you lean forward.
I mean, you know, the way this year is going, might as well.
It's incredible to see you both. Had either of you read this particular issue, Marvel Team-Up Annual Number 1, before?
Funny enough, yes. And I remember how fun, but also insane it was. And it is a miracle that no one knows Peter Parker's identity.
Yeah. Thanks, Professor X.
Yeah.
Marewa, had you read it?
Oh, no, I'm not familiar with the issue. I've not read the issue.
So, yeah.
So it was all new experience reading it.
This is a crazy one. The word count is really high. There's a lot of words per page.
Oh, yes.
And there's a ton of exposition given to a group of new characters that don't really get used very much and have literally never been seen again. So we're going to skip over some of the intense exposition. Now, the X-Men in the mid-1970s, one of the things we've been exploring on my show in 2025 is this kind of multicultural group of heroes. We're seeing this more and more in media around this time in the 70s. We're seeing it in Star Trek as we see kind of a group of diverse heroes. And then, you know, we go to the 90s when I was like babysitting my niece and nephew, and they were watching like Barney, and every episode had like one kid of every color hanging out. And like my kids watching Daniel Tiger, one kid of every color hanging out. And then I think back to my childhood with like Captain Planet, and like there's one kid from every country on the team. And so this becomes kind of a consistent trope. And I think the diversity is really lovely. There seems to be a lot of care given to forming these teams, with the X-Men being the backdrop for this, but also this new group called the Lords of Light and Darkness that we'll be getting to in a minute. What are your thoughts, Stephanie, first on this multicultural groups of people coming together as if everyone just gets along?
Gotta love the 70s, carrying over that 60s, all things love. It's incredibly progressive when you look back at the time, that this is something that, even if it was a conscious move or subconscious, it's just kind of cool to see that. Whenever I go back and read these older issues, Silver Age, Bronze Age, I'm always, things weren't all bad. I'll put it that way. Like they were, but also there were people that were trying to show diversity, even if it was shoehorned in sometimes. But this issue, funny enough, is, I would say, progressive given the time. And that seems to be a lot of Marvel Bronze Age comics.
I wish it was reflected in the creative team, however, which is just mostly white people. And mostly white men at that. But it is important to see that diversity, of course. Mireille, what do you want to tell us about the cover of this book? It's a really fun Cockrum action shot that not a lot of people have seen.
It's so dynamic and action-packed. For a while, I thought it was going to be revealed to be Nimrod or something. But yeah, but I love the cover. It feels very X-Men more than Spider-Man, though. So yeah, it's...
We've got this massive robot with like giant extendo arms and huge hooks fighting all the heroes at once.
Yeah, so we see this as an X-Men fan, you would definitely want to read this. And so I was waiting for it to be something almost like Sentinel based or something. But when I realized that, oh, this wasn't the direction they were going. But it's the robots were a cool addition in the story too.
So we've got this robot gripping Colossus. Spider-Man is swinging in. Storm's blasting lightning. Wolverine is slashing with claws. I mean, they've been practicing on the Sentinels for a long time, right? Nightcrawler's leaping in. We get his tail kind of prominently featured, which I always love. And the only thing weird about this cover is Cyclops is so teeny tiny. He looks like he's about a foot and a half tall, just kind of shoved in perspective at the bottom as he blasts the robot's inner thigh. Double the action, double the thrills. Comics in this time were 30 cents. This one is 50 cents. It's an annual, so it's a double feature.
It's a big boy.
And we jump right in. This splash page is the Lords of Light and Darkness. We've got the X-Men and Spider-Man running in front of a kind of nuclear radioactive mushroom cloud. It says Chapter 1, The Nest. And then there's a little cutout from a news headline on the top left that talks about there's a nuclear explosion. A hydrogen warhead has exploded in a remote area of Nevada. Now, this is in the post-Vietnam War years. The threat of nuclear annihilation and the Cold War is very present and alive and well from the 50s kind of all the way into the 80s. The Cold War is alive and well. And we, you know, dropped a bomb on Japan or a couple of bombs on Japan just a few years before. And this is also the testing area. So, I mean, the X-Men we've talked about on my show multiple times, the Children of the Atom, the idea that these characters were all exposed to some sort of radiation or their parents were, and that's where they're born mutants is kind of an early theme. But we also have these explored with Daredevil, who like radioactive stuff falls on his eyes, and Spider-Man's bitten by a radioactive spider, and Hulk's in a radio, like a gamma bomb. And like, it's just such an early part of all of our superheroes. So that threat of nuclear is very present here.
It's beautiful. And I love when a comic does start with a splash page, but one that, I don't know, like this one is letting you know, like, well, this is how we got here. But let's tell you how the heroes actually got in this moment. So it's a really great splash page. I will say to the radioactive piece, it's very interesting to me that for a lot of American media around that time, like your people are getting powers. Meanwhile, in Japan, you know, the result of that is Godzilla and a punishment for this versus a reward for radioactive or nuclear transformation, and your reward is becoming a hero.
Yeah, I'm telling you, if you got bit by a radioactive spider, you're going to shoot stuff out of your butt, but it's not webs.
No, you're going to be in for a very bad time.
There's a lot even word count here. We've got Stan Lee presents Spidey and the Uncanny X-Men together. This is one of the first times the word uncanny is used to reference the X-Men. It is not on the main cover of the books at this point. It says from a plot by Bill Mantlo, Chris Claremont, and Bonnie Wilford. We've talked about Chris and Bonnie a little bit on the show. They were romantically connected. There's even a character named after her who's like the flight attendant friend of Amanda Sefton in the books. Bill Mantlo's the writer here with Sal Buscema and Mike Esposito on art. Jim Novak's the letterer. Hugh Paley on colors and Archie Goodwin the editor. So literally an all white male team. I love a lot of Bill Mantlo stuff, especially from the 70s and early 80s. His Alpha Flight, his Incredible Hulk. There's some crazy stuff. The logo here, the lettering, the Lords in red, of Light in yellow, and Darkness in black. It's like very dynamic. And and then we've got kind of it all layered and put together. And again, these are relatively new heroes. So I'm going to do the intro to this book very quickly as we talk about the early stuff. But let me put my continuity hat on. I'm the handbook guy, right? This issue came out around the time when Jean had just crashed onto the Earth from the spaceship and turned into the Phoenix. There is no reference for what the Phoenix is. We do not know what the Phoenix Force is. We got that giant like burst out of the water kind of god moment. Then she goes to the hospital. So at this point, it just seems to be kind kind of Jean who has unlocked a new level of her powers. But we're going to see some stuff with her later in this issue where they kind of recognize her god potential, which is very interesting. And she was burning so bright here that they didn't notice Storm's god potential, which is something where I was been exploring a lot in his books. we'll get there in a little bit too. So we open on a place called The Nest, which is a secret underground facility in the middle of the Nevada desert. And there's some airships coming in, bringing a new individual to come and survey this research. So we meet a guy named, and I'm going to introduce these characters quickly because they're ultimately kind of inconsequential, but we see a guy named United States Senate Operative Stephen Marchese, who is coming there to meet his team. It's very unfortunate that his ex-wife is on the team along with her new boyfriend, but we really don't get much more than just him going, oh, this sucks. So there's a whole team of people here, including nuclear physicist and project administrator Brian Mann, who's white, biophysicist Dr. Vic Norman, who is black, a guy that's studying radiation's impact on life. We've got electrical engineer Jan Marshall, who appears to be a kind of Norwegian or Nordic, I think, who's building robots called Rax. And he names the Rax, R-A-K-K, after the Rakshasa, or the Hindu demon guardians of hell. So keep that in mind for a little later. Karen Lee is here. She's Korean, and she's...
You mentioned it multiple times.
Yeah, yeah. Karen Lee is here. She is Korean, and she's the ex-wife of Marchese. There's an astronomer named Sifan Chung, who is Chinese. He was the new boyfriend of Karen. There's a radiation expert named Dr. Martin Aronson. And then there's the project overseer, Randy Tate, who... That just sounds like the porniest porn name I've ever heard. It's a blonde girl, Randy Tate. I don't know. I'm here for you. Irradiation specialist Araman Nila is there as well. And there's a specific mention. It's always interesting to me when we put a timestamp on this, that he left India just before Indira Gandhi pledged the minds of scientists to like working for the state, which is kind of the opposite of what's happening in America these days as we deny science completely. Any thoughts on this very quick setup? We don't need to delve deep into these characters because again, they're not around for very long before they get transformed.
Discovering later that the characters end up becoming consequential was a shocker because especially when we got introduced to the Spider-Man and the other, it felt very jarring because I'm like, oh, I was getting all invested here with, you know, the guy here to visit them that his ex-wife was also working here and with, you know, the new boo and everything. So it's, I felt intrigued with the dynamics that was going on and I thought it was, you know, going places, you know, but I also love some of the references to Hindu culture, which was a good setup for what was revealed later. So that, you know, so it's a good setup that it's very, very engaging and makes you believe in more.
Oh, yeah. Mariwa and Stephanie, both of you, when I read your books, I have to read slowly. And that's a compliment. I like to read slowly. You guys pack a lot into your descriptions and your art. And in order to kind of see the character relationships, I need to watch what's happening. I need to take my time. I love that type of read. This just feels like a lot of unnecessary exposition. All the stuff I just recounted is...
Oh, yes.
All the stuff I just recounted was in 3 pages. And these pages have like 8 to 12 panels on each one. It's really, there's a lot. And on the end of the third page, the guy that's from India specifically, who apparently is Hindu, because we're going to meet a whole bunch of like Hindu god interpretations in a minute. Araman Nila, he like drops the nuclear rod because there's a little earthquake and there's a giant nuclear explosion that's going to kill a whole bunch of people. But it ends up transforming all of these folks here, with the exception of Marchese, who's the point of view character on page one, who seems to just kind of die. We've never seen Marchese ever again. But all of the scientists get transformed, except for Nila, who is killed. We'll get there in just a moment.
Much just to blow it up literally on that third page, but or fourth or fifth page. But man, like you could not get away with this now.
Yeah, there's a lot. There's a lot happening here. And if that's not enough, by the time we get to page 5, we are about to meet a whole bunch more characters because there's also a plane carrying a bunch of people who are coming to survey the research here that's happening at the nuclear facility. Among them are people that we don't really need to worry about, like their names. I'm not even going to spend time, but there's Russian delegates that are like ranting about the Cold War. This Peter Parker's here representing, they said he's here as both an auditor and reporter, and he gets kind of singled out by a man with a red mustache named Sir Lionel, who's like, I'm going to take you under my wing, boy, who I just think he's gay and found Peter kind of hot. And in the back, it turns out Reed Richards is also supposed to have been here, but he wasn't able to make it, so he sent Professor X in his stead, and Professor X brought all of his students. So we have a full lineup of X-Men. There's also a senator here named Senator Stoneface Turner, who is a character from from the Skull the Slayer series, which is about a white adventurer getting lost in the Bermuda Triangle with some friends. There's a whole lore over there as well. And this guy's just a loud American senator who we've never ever seen again as well. So he has three appearances, two in Skull the Slayer, one here. There's all the character setup you need before we jump to the X-Men. I'm tripping over the stuff that's just not truly necessary here. Stephanie, do you want to talk to us about this first group shot of the X-Men that we get? Xavier just kind of comes out of the back of the plane with the whole team.
We have the X-Men, and what I miss a lot, which is seeing them in regular civilian clothing, because they always had a fresh fit on, courtesy of Professor X. It's just kind of funny that he's like, yeah, so I'm bringing my student. Okay, do they need to be here? Well, quite obviously they do, but it's just funny that every time he pops up, they are there and they're wearing suits, dresses, and everything else.
Whose clothing do you like best here? Because they're all dressed very well. Cyclops has got a turtleneck and a jacket. Banshee's looking like he's spending a day in his Irish castle. Storm's dress is gorgeous.
My favorite might actually be Cyclops because of the turtleneck. I'm a sucker for a turtleneck and a suit.
Yeah,
and
that's my favorite too, Cyclops.
Wolverine's super gay though. Oh, yeah, yeah. Wolverine's still developing as a character as well, right? These are all new characters, but this is where his hair started to take on its characteristic. It almost looks like he's like an owl here. It looks like he's got like owl tufted ears.
Yes.
He roughs up the senator a little bit and like, I don't like your tone, bub. He needs a touch more respect. Spider-Man has met the X-Men in an early Marvel team-up book when they were disbanded. I've covered that on my show, but there's also a retroactive continuity that shows them meeting more times, including in places like Untold Tales of Spider-Man. I've covered most of that content on my show in the past. So he knows enough to say, ooh, Professor X is like a superhero guy, which means these other people must also be superheroes. We also, in January on the show, just covered Nightcrawler and Spider-Man's team-up in the Amazing Spider-Man book, where they got to like have a big battle against Punisher and Jigsaw. Now, the pilots up ahead see like a nuclear bomb has gone off, so they're flying into a huge black cloud. The X-Men, who have just recently crashed from space, are not having the best time. Everyone is in a lot of danger, but not only are they in danger of crashing, but all of those Rak or Rakshasa robots that are guarding the gates of hell in mythology shoot up to attack the plane as well, and the pilots get blinded. Luckily, there's a whole group of superheroes on board, so everyone's lucky and no one's gonna die. Stephanie, do you want to talk to us about some of the early moments in the X-Men versus the robots battles? Tell us some of your favorites here.
I just love how one Spider-Man sneaks off to the bathroom and forgets to lock the door to change his clothes and almost gets had. So also
he has to hide on the ceiling so the guy doesn't
insane. but then them, you know, just saying, well, if we're gonna fight these things, we're gonna have to burst the plane open on the side. So we're not gonna open the hatch, we'll just create a hole and fly on out. You can see that because they're still so early much in their teendom of it all, like we're not seeing a lot of, I don't want to say necessarily working together. Like we get Banshee and Storm flying around, but we haven't really gotten that the team up in Cyclops or Colossus with Wolverine and that type of thing where we're getting like these power sets or these coordinated attacks because they're still so fresh together. So I always found that a little interesting.
Storm and Banshee are very suddenly in costume, right? Spidey had to run to the bathroom, but they like change in the air. They fly outside and just drop their clothes and had their uniforms on underneath. And then, you know, the X-Men are like shifting as they go. Cyclops has a harder time changing. There's an early panel of Cyclops blasting his rays like through his sunglasses, which is odd. And then I think Chris was like, oh,
describe it as it's flipped or something like that.
Yeah, he's like, the ruby quartz lenses on his glasses like flipped up. That's how he was able to do this.
Yeah, like, yeah, sure. The science in this first couple of scenes, I'm like, I don't think pressurized aircraft work this way, where you just keep puncturing holes and in the aircraft and people are not like flying through the holes and everything. And yet you're saying that the plane is nosediving and sometimes you see them walking straight up. And it's like, I don't think the physics work. And I think you guys should have died like 5 minutes ago. You know, there's a lot of suspension of disbelief that you have to do to like make all this work.
So Cyclops blasts a hole in the plane. The robot's reaching through it. Spider-Man kicks it back. Aurora and Sean fly out of the plane, and then Spider-Man seals it up behind them with webs. We've got Colossus and Cyclops trying to stabilize the plane while another robot reaches through the floor, ripping another hole. And now Colossus is like punching shit. Things are exploding. Nightcrawler's vamping around. Wolverine's popped his claws. He's still in his suit. Jean's still in her blue dress. There's some fun dialogue for the moments. It's heading right for us, Elf.
Perhaps for you, my friend, but not for Nightcrawler. Not when I can teleport myself Automation's path, shedding my image of normalcy along the way. He had his image inducer, which leaves it up to us, bub. That's the way the Wolverine likes it. It's all yours, lady. And Jean's, my mind blast can disrupt the thing's circuits, but that's not going to slow it down. Spider-Man jumps in. Leave that to me, m'lady Jean. Us neighborhood Spider-Men aim to please. They just don't build them like they used to. Thank God for that. Professor X, if I may be so bold as to remind you young people of something, we are in an aircraft that is in the process of crashing, and unless you all relish the prospect of dying, might I suggest you act before it becomes too late, which is what Murray was just telling us. Like, oh my God, we're punching robots and we're all gonna die. So Cyclops does not know how to blast a plane. Then we go outside. Murray, what do you want to take the narrative here for a minute? Tell us about the next battle section.
I was first like worried, like, oh, I hope Storm is going to do something cool in this issue because I wanted Storm to do something cool. So I was happy when Banshee and Storm were, you know, the ones taking out the major, you know, robots outside, because I think the robots are trying to distract both of them so that the plane wouldn't be able to land with their help. So then Spider-Man takes charge and, you know, creates a parachute for the plane with web stuff, you know,
and it's able to land the plane safely. Banshee,
the beasties appear to be easing off a wee bit, but not enough to let us get Cyclops and the others.
And then we get this amazing moment. It's a very small panel of Storm just completely flanked by lightning. They seek to delay us, Banshee. While the plane crashes, they must not succeed. Once they're on the ground, everyone's immediately like, oh, look, it's the X-Men. Fuck those guys. We hate mutants. And Cyclops flips around.
They cost this.
Senator, we just saved your neck. And if you can't understand that, it may be Wolverine who'll be stopping me from tearing into you.
And they're like, okay, guys, there's a nuclear bomb that just went off. We got to figure out what the fuck is happening here. The Russian luckily has brought some sophisticated radiation detectors to figure out where they need to go. And also, he has some anti-radiation spray. So anyone who wants to jump in there...
No.
You get 1 hour of no radiation.
I loved that. That's...
I grew up watching 1960s Batman. Like, I loved old TV when I was a teenager. So in the 90s, I was watching a lot of old Batman. And there's a feature-length Batman movie. Have either of you seen? It's an hour and 10 minutes or something. It's Adam West and Burt Ward.
No, unfortunately.
Oh, highly recommended. It's so cringe. Okay, so there's a moment. They're in the Batcopter. And it's just floating in air with no one piloting it. And they need to get to a boat down below. So they suspend a rope ladder. And Batman climbs down the rope ladder to get to the boat, but then the boat turns into a submarine and disappears. So Batman's leg lands in a water, and then as he comes up out of the water, climbing the ladder again, there's a full shark attached to his leg.
Oh, the shark repellent spray.
Yeah, so he has a leg, and the shark is biting on the leg, and he's like, oh no! And he yells up to the helicopter, and he goes, Robin, get me the anti-shark repellent. So Robin opens a little
compartment
that was prepared in the helicopter, and there's like anti-stingray repellent, anti-dolphin repellent, anti-shark repellent. So he grabs that one. He tosses it down to Batman, who's on the rope ladder. Batman takes the lid off and sprays it like it's an aerosol can on the shark, who then dismounts into the water again. This radiation is giving me that. It's my favorite thing ever.
I've seen that scene. That's why I laughed too. It reminded me of that too. Yeah.
Stephanie's living for this, I can tell.
I mean, of course.
What else are we going to do with it, right? Okay, so we have our anti-radiation spray. And now the X-Men have sprayed themselves along with Spider-Man. And we get into chapter 3 called Into Hell Pit. They've found a crack in the mountain. They are rushing in. And Jean is still not in her Phoenix suit. Everyone else is now in their superhero clothes. And Jean's in her blue dress and boots, which I love. Wolverine, think you can keep up with us, webhead? Spider-Man says, I've been keeping up with for years, friend. And since I don't hear them talking about you as the amazing Wolverine, I must be doing something right. Nightcrawler, Wolverine seeks to bait you, my friend. He seems to find some measure of security in the belittling of others. Watch it, Elf. I bite. So again, these are early character moments for these guys. It's excellent. Professor X is straining to get messages through to everyone. Like, watch out in there. It's going to be dangerous, but he has to stay outside. They check on him. Are you okay, Professor? I'm well, Doctor. For a man living in a nightmare. So Banshee and Storm are the first two to rush in. They are, Spider-Man is worried. Irish and the lady can take care of themselves, Wallcrawler. Anyone asking you for suggestions? And I don't recall anyone asking you for anything, Big Mouth. That did it, chum. He pops his claws. Cyclops like, Wolverine! Nightcrawler has to break up the fight, and they are ready to finally enter the radiation dome. I know I'm covering this quickly. I'm going to pause for conversation shortly. Once we jump in, we now see some very dangerous things. Storm and Banshee are the first to get in there.
They immediately get hit because they did no type of recon. Well, Storm gets hit first by something we'll see on the next page. And then Banshee, of course, is yelling at the top of his lungs at Storm. She hits the ground. And yeah, we find out where all this radiation is coming from.
So after Storm gets hit, Banshee goes, she's dropping the fiendish thingy, hurt her. The fiendish thingy, which is...
Because, I mean, well, it is kind of like a thingy, so he's right. Because what is that?
It's the chaos wheel. Okay, we're just going to pause for all of the exposition here very quickly. And we're going to talk about gods for a few minutes before we continue with this crazy story. All of the people on the research team, the one that's from India got killed because he was closest to the radiation blast. But his mind transported all of his religious beliefs, his thoughts about the gods. And then somehow those thoughts became the irradiated presences of everyone else on the research team who are now amplified up to like culturally appropriated the Hindu gods or like the version of that that would exist based on this man's thoughts transforming these people. And now, of course, they want to like conquer. We're going to sacrifice everyone on the planet so that we can be gods. This transformation is wild. Let me hear first. Stephanie, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this idea of transformation. And if you want to talk a little bit about Nightshade here, it would be great because this is a character who got like radiated up to superpowers too.
What a jump and conclude, like what a jump. And also for them to go from scientist and we want to help humanity to now we are, you know, these godlike beings and we want to destroy everyone so that we can ascend to godhood is quite the leap, as is his thoughts transforming them into that. I do think it's interesting because when they spent the time in the beginning trying to set up who these characters are and give us their job titles, I was trying to find connections between the actual gods that they represent and like the job title that they had. We could fudge some things, but there really isn't like a ton of connection. In that, I'm just like, okay, so we just wanted to create these, they wouldn't be villains. I think they're just poorly misguided scientists who got irradiated.
And some of these characters with their god names, these gods, of course, actually exist in the Marvel Universe.
Yeah.
Shiva, Brahma, and Vishnu being right at the top. Oh, Vishnu, Kali, yeah. Too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a bunch. So the first one we meet, and let me have you comment on these characters if you would like to. The first one we meet is Jan Marshall has changed into Yama Dharma, the Death Lord. And the real god Yama is one of the old Vedic deities appearing in the Rig Veda as the first mortal to die and the ruler and judge of the dead. He exists in Hindu, Buddhist, and Jain traditions, governs death, the afterlife, and moral judgment rather than acting as some force of evil. And he's wielding this like chaos wheel. And that's what he hit Storm with. He looks like Thor. He's in the red with the yellow beard.
Oh, yeah. I don't know, no comments. I was going to be interested in Vishnu, but they're all like weird representations because like you said, they're already these gods already exist in the Marvel Universe themselves. And I was wondering why they put them in shadow because even when they came out, I was like, I still don't know who these guys are until they gave me explanation that, oh, they were the scientists. So like, why are they all being cagey? If the one guy that was Hindu, if he was American, what would have happened?
Yeah, I don't know. Radiation? I don't want to know.
But I had Paul Bunyan.
So the X-Men fight this initial god. Nightcrawler gets to kick him. Wolverine slashes him open, but it's just like a black hole, cosmic hole inside of him. And he like just like seals his wound up, apparently. He's blasting everyone out. And the X-Men are very swiftly defeated because very quickly we have the second god joining the fight. And this is Karen Lee as Kali, the Black Madness, they call her. Now, the real god Kali is a fierce goddess of time, death, and transformation in Hinduism, particularly central to Shakta traditions, with major myths developing in the Puranas and the Tantras. Though terrifying in form, she represents the destruction of evil, liberation from ego, and protective maternal power. For those that love the character Necra, she initially worships the goddess Kali when we first meet Necra here.
I love the suit. Because, like, are there like skulls on like around her on her boots at the top? Like, where'd that come from? I mean, so okay, suspending belief. This is a great suit, but also what and why? and I forgot to mention about just to go back to Nightshade real quick. Here's the thing: I am a scientist. I was doing work in hopes of helping and healing people, having some type of positive impact on you know, the greater community at large. So for her, it was important for me that even when she got transformed, she ended up being kind of a reluctant hero because she just wanted to cure sickle cell. But now here she is with these powers and a PhD that she just got, and she just wants to get a job. But in this universe, if you have powers, for her, trying to figure out, what am I going to do with these? Do I want to continue my work, or am I going to lean all the way into the superhero of it all? She tries to do both, but unfortunately it doesn't work out.
Everyone is defeated. Colossus is the last one standing. He's like, why do you strain against the inevitable? Because I am Colossus being, I cannot do a Russian accent. That's the one I'm terrible at. Because I am X-Man, because I'm and he collapses. And then these two gods are like, ooh, look at that white woman. We need her. Which is...
Sure.
Jean has the Phoenix powers. Now, this is something we can add retroactively. They recognize the godly potential within her. And the big thing here is these eight gods want to ascend to godhood, but they need a ninth god to stabilize them somehow. So they change Jean into her Phoenix suit and put everyone else in like a suspension field as they want Jean to like help them ascend. We're going to meet the rest of the gods here kind of in just a couple of panels very quickly, because all the X-Men are trapped and they can't really get out. And then we get one panel that points to all of the different characters with a little like a blurb telling us who they are with arrows that point. And it's just like, it's, we needed like full page reveals for these characters because they're trying to make them a really big deal. We've got Ahriman Nila here turned into Agni, the Lord of Fire. Agni is a major Vedic deity of ancient India, appearing prominently in the Rig Veda, where he personifies fire itself and serves as the divine medium carrying offerings from humans to the gods. He governs sacrificial fire, domestic hearths, and transformation, acting as both purifier and messenger between worlds. And I want to be clear, everyone, I'm providing these summaries. The text gives us nothing. It's just
nothing.
Just words.
There's a lot of fire. We're done. They're all weird. And the fact that they're all different, especially, you know, I don't also want to make it racial, but it all feels weird, you know, because now have, you know, white guys that are like, you know, Hindu gods, and it's just all weird, and I don't know.
Vic Norman, the black guy, is the one that becomes Agni. I said that incorrectly before. Brian Mann becomes Brahma. Brahma's the Hindu creator god associated with cosmic creation and knowledge, emerging clearly in later Vedic and post-Vedic literature, though part of the Trimurti with Vishnu and Shiva. He's rarely worshipped and functions primarily as a mythological architect of the universe rather than an active devotional deity.
I mean, sure, I guess. I think the thing that's getting me about this is that they take the time to tell us who they are, but we don't see their powers work in that way at all. Not even a little bit. I don't know, like, what was the, I guess, other than naming them after Hindu gods, there was no other purpose.
Yeah, there's, it's kind of very quick. Now, Brahma and the character Ratri, who's the white woman here, have the same costume. So Ratri Knight is Randy Tate, our favorite porn actress. Ratri is a Vedic goddess of night mentioned in the Rig Veda, where she represents the protective and restorative aspects of darkness rather than chaos or evil. She governs rest, shelter, shelter and safety during the night and is closely associated with cosmic balance. Mariwa, any comments on Ratri? You could just say
none.
Okay. I have Martin Aronson as Mara the Dreamer. Mara is a figure in Buddhist cosmology, first appearing in early Buddhist texts, representing temptation, illusion, and death rather than a creator god. He's best known for attempting to prevent Siddhartha Gautama's enlightenment by embodying desire, fear, and distraction. So kind of the tempter character. And I like that they made this one a male, actually. Although he's kind of a fugly little guy. Little zigzag belt.
They gave him the ugliest suit and they did not like that man.
We have Sifan Chung as Shiva. Shiva is one of the principal deities of Hinduism, associated with destruction, renewal, aestheticism, and cosmic balance, with roots in the Vedic texts and possibly pre-Vedic traditions. He embodies paradox, both destroyer and benefactor, and is worshipped as the ultimate reality in Shaivism.
He has a cool weapon, though.
Yeah, he's got like a little zigzaggy trident. It's cool.
Yeah.
Now, if you've read the Weapon X stuff in Wolverine, Weapon X Project later designs robots called Shiva robots to like hunt down all their test subjects. So yeah, a little different story there. And then the last one we see is Vishnu, Vishnu the Preserver. This is Victor Norman. Vishnu is the major Hindu deity associated with preservation, order, and cosmic stability, whose role expanded significantly from early Vedic texts into the Puranic period. He's best known for his avatars, including Rama and Krishna, through which he restores Dharma when cosmic balance is threatened. Stephanie, any comments on Vishnu?
No. The knight. That's the only thing I was like, oh, the black guy is the knight.
So yeah.
Congratulations.
Ratri's the knight. So the arrow.
No, Patrick's knight is the preserver.
Okay. Gotcha. Yeah, okay.
I was expecting the most from Vishnu.
This is why we don't do arrows like this. In captions.
This is all one battle. Okay, now we can just let ourselves get superhero battle crazy. Stephanie, tell us about the X-Men freeing themselves through like tag team wrestling style through this containment field.
Okay, I will say it is pretty cool that Nightcrawler uses his power to create a rift in whatever that energy field is. So I was like, okay, now we're doing some in-world comic thinking. So I thought that was pretty cool. And to just have them popping out of the force field and like doing their thing. So Colossus, Cyclops, of course, and then Spider-Man. And now they're just all out. Well, why did it take them that long to figure that out?
I don't know. They're distracted.
Yeah.
Banshee often gets like concentric circles coming out of his mouth or sometimes like a little blast. This is a weird, it looks like Banshee's a ghost. There's like weird spirit escalating out of his mouth. It's so odd. It's like vomiting. I don't know. It's weird. Wolverine and Storm have a moment where Storm is the one to free Wolverine by channeling the powers of a raging hurricane. And he says, pardon the pun, you just blow me away.
I have a screenshot of that. I had to take a screenshot of that.
Mirewa recently got to write these characters fucking. Were they fucking back then, do you think?
No, I think Wolverine had a crush. I've been seeing more and more comics that I've been reading like since very early they met. I was like, oh yeah, Wolverine definitely had a crush on Storm for a long time.
I agree, because he was it was the old boys picking on you, so they must like you, because he was a jerk to her for a good little while. So it's always nice to see their progression in their relationship.
In the early Claremont stuff, there's a lot of like white-splaining to Storm going on. I mean, she like clothes off all the time and they're like, Storm, what are you trying to do? They're just kind of getting mad at her, especially if you read the classic X-Men backups. Angel tries to fuck her early on. Like the night she arrives at the mansion, he's like, hey, gorgeous. And she's like, no, you're gorgeous. But then he instead gets jealous because Wolverine's flirting with Jean and like the whole plot gets abandoned. But Angel and Storm together does not work in my brain. It's not the same.
It doesn't. It's weird.
So Jean wants to help the gods ascend, and that's the way to help them. I don't know. It's kind of an odd little story. We get some fun superhero battle moments here as the X-Men fight the gods. You can just take it and stuff it, pal, because such is the will of Wolverine.
The fight is pretty actually badass. And yes, we do see the god of fire actually grab onto Wolverine. And it's like, oh, it burns. I was like, yeah, because I'm the, god of fire. You know, it's action packed. But the X-Men find them very difficult to defeat until, Storm has to tag in, and Storm does like a little cyclone, and then they get their form gets destabilized. And I think that's when the heroes now have a little sympathy for them, that they might actually, I think, lose, maybe die or get destroyed or something. But then they give like a whole threat that, oh, if we lose our energy, we are linked to Earth or something. So they
well, there was also just like, there was also just a nuclear explosion, right? Like, this is going to kill a lot of people. Storm gets wrapped in darkness in one panel. We get like Banshee vomiting white energy again to like take another god down, and the gods get disarmed by Cyclops. One of the gods, Mara the Dreamer, gets to give off like gay rainbow powers. He's like, it's like very Care Bear stare. He spreads his arms and like every color of the rainbow spreads, and Jean's like, oh no, it's colors. Cyclops gets to punch a guy. And then this moment with Storm, after she gets out of the darkness, I can see again, breathe again. I am no longer confined. Now let lightning dispel the darkness. Let the storm now reign supreme. And all of the gods are like getting caught up in this hurricane, swirl, swirl, swirl around. Finally, Jean is like, let's help. Everybody hold hands.
Yeah.
Let's stand here together.
I was like, that was a 180.
And Jean's like, I will help you ascend to godhood. It's fine. Then she starts to scream. Everybody's kind of freaking out a little bit. Nightcrawler's bamfing around. They're blasting some beams. They don't want Jean to die, obviously. It's very Care Bear stare. They're all like channeling together. Storm gets another really cool moment because she's like the cooling system. We're seeing her powers in some cool ways. We got lightning, we got wind, and now she gets to like decrease the temperature in the area.
I'm like, sorry, Iceman.
And then finally, they turn all their powers and the gods ascend into space and apparently become a new star. And all of the radioactive energy went with it. It's a giant. Mm-hmm. I don't remember when they shot Krakoa into space at the end of like Giant Size X-Men number one. It almost feels like that. So there's a new star in the sky. All the radiation is gone. And then we get like a very quick two-panel denouement of the entire thing. Professor Xavier, unethically, deletes the superhero identities out of everyone on plane. In their mind, and Spider-Man goes, huh, just like that. Boy, he'd be a handy guy to have around when it comes time to explain things to a certain Mary Jane Watson. And then we are over. The story is finished.
One, it made me think of the way that they take them down. Fantastic Four, not the original, but the one from the early 2000s. So that very first one where at the end they defeat Dr. Doom by working together to turn him into a molting thing of metal. So we don't get that exactly, but this idea of combining all of our strengths and our powers, and then Cyclops blasting them off into space. What?
Yeah.
And the fact that it was Spider-Man's idea to send them to space because he's taken some physics classes, so apparently he knows. But yeah, we wrap things up nicely.
I would much rather have had almost 20 pages of like the heroes versus the gods with just some like text bubbles telling us what. Yeah. It's so much. It's just so dense.
And throw them in the Thanos copter or something. If you want to be silly, let's be silly.
We have never seen these characters again. They went into space. These characters do get an entry, like a handbook entry in one of the like special X-Men handbooks. You can go look it up like on the Marvel Wiki, but we've truly just never seen them again. It's a truly bizarre story. Now, where I want to spend a little bit of our time now that we finished the issue review, Marewa, let me have you start here. You're someone who's been playing a ton with the idea of cosmic gods and cultural traditions as they meld in and out of like the Marvel version of those gods interacting with characters like Storm. In Rogue Storm, you have this gorgeous opening to the third issue where we get to see Storm's kind of lineage going all the way back to Ashtur and the way she can channel her family's like legacy and energy. And then she's facing these giant gods in some of your recent work. Let me hear what it's been like for you to play in that sandbox. Melding cultural traditions with comic book lore is something every Thor writer has had to face, right?
I've been enjoying that a lot because right now in the new iteration of the Storm series, I'm even writing about the Olympian gods and more about the Orishas. It's fun taking some of those archetypes from mythology and trying to see how it works with, you know, these modern characters and how it bounces off. And getting to design them afresh is also very interesting. You know, putting some Greek designs, Yoruba designs into them. So that's why I really wanted this characters to look really cool from this story that we read, because, you know, I love seeing the aspects of their culture represented in these gods, and which leans a little to what we've said in the beginning about, you know, books like Giant Size X-Men 1 and everything, where there's this freshness and newness that comes into a book when you have characters from different cultures. They speak differently, they dress differently, they use different colors, you know, and everything just comes together thematically, visually, and even in the dialogue, everything, to just bring this freshness to the story. That's, it's just lovely. And you know, seeing Zeus, you know, trying to, you know, tussle against Olorun, something you would not typically see, you know, it's just fun to play with in the Marvel Universe, because in the Marvel Universe, they all exist. Just, they're all neighbors of each other, which makes it, you know, really, really fun.
This is a smaller version of that same type of story. But Stephanie, there's a Scarlet Witch backup story where you got to write Aurora and Wanda teaming up and like handling like a water spirit. So this kind of same idea of realm, whether it's small scale or large scale, do you want to talk a little bit about working with those like kind of mythology in Marvel?
To Moira's point, like they already exist. So how do you bring them forth and make them look cool? So when I was like, well, if Wanda is going to go get tea, let's go on to Ireland, because why not? I looked up just some different, just mythical beasts and just folklore, whatever I could find. And I was like, oh, well, it would be kind of cool to have this water god, so to speak, or kind of this guardian here pop up. And yeah, I spent way more research and tabs on that than I probably should have for like all of two pages. Mm-hmm. But it's important because, again, like you wanted to not only just look cool, but if anybody is into that, they'll hopefully like, okay, you did a good job.
I guarantee both of you, and this is not to slight any of the writers, again, I'm a big Bill Mantlo fan, but I guarantee both of you have done tons more research than anyone on this issue did about these Hindu gods.
The internet helps.
Now, the reason I think this issue fit into this theme this month, the theme being voodoo, and for those that have been listening to the show, I opened my show this month with an incredible interview with an academic talking all about voodoo in pop culture and its kind of appropriation. It's an interesting thing to watch these white writers create these templates of god characters, but the story being told again is like this one Indian man projected his ideas of gods through radiation into this group of people, and they became... It's a crazy story. What are your thoughts on the appropriation kind of theme that we so frequently see in our comics, taking the sacred traditions of other gods and putting them into our characters? We see it with Asian, Indian, Hindu, and especially, I think, Native American traditions almost the most.
It's a problem when enough research and care has not been put into that. I do think that, I don't know, it's important to infuse different cultural things into our media, but it's doubly important to make sure you're doing so with care, or if it's something that is even okay for you to do. I recently learned that when it comes to owl imagery for some indigenous populations, that is something they don't want to see because it's a bad omen. So you should probably put a spoiler before that, just little things like that. So most of the time when we see it, it's not done well, and it is straight up appropriation, just like in this issue where they're just this just because. We don't even see their powers reflect, you know, what that manifestation could be for those gods in this universe. They're just kind of there in name only, not even in costume. I mean, I'm forward if the research is done properly and there is a story, there's a reason that it makes sense that you absolutely need to infuse this cultural piece into your story, but also maybe you don't. You could just make something up, especially if it's gonna be, you're just gonna make them white anyway, so you might as well just make it up, right? Instead of you know, doing this hodgepodge thing of very real cultural you know, religions, beings and gods. If you're just gonna whitewash them anyway, you might as well just make it up.
Yeah, when we see, again, we see this most frequently with characters like Thor and Hercules, who are white gods based in white traditions. And it doesn't feel like appropriation so much. It just feels like a fun superhero universe. But whenever it is a god from a cultural tradition that has been appropriated by white people, the kind of stuff that white people moved into your culture, took it away, and then put it in a museum, that feels very different, right? Like, it's a different kind of ballgame. But when written with sensitivity, Marewa, I love your Storm run. I'm super excited for Storm Earth's Mightiest Mutant. When we see it kind of elevated, and then combined with the tradition of things, it's really delightful. Marewa, I really commend you for the amount of research you've done, doing the type of stuff you're doing with characters like Oblivion and Eternity, for example, who are Marvel cosmic elevated gods, the idea of creation, which is what Stephanie just recommended, mixing them with the tradition of let's bring all the storm gods in, have a big smash them up fight, and have a great time with storm kicking ass.
I also think maybe some of the things that in that some of those stories back then is, I think some of them were well-intentioned, but they were, for example, let's say the Hindu gods, you know, I think to them, their audience were American, the American audience. I don't think even their subconscious pictured that anyone from India would be reading this. So, and I think that kind of affects how you represent something. So it's when you're telling the story of Zeus, you're like, oh yeah, everyone knows about Zeus. Everyone has learned about Zeus in school. There are some things I shouldn't get wrong. There are some things that should, like, I can take creative liberties, but there are some things that, oh, once you remove this element, it's no longer Zeus, you know, and things like that. So they know those things subconsciously. But if you know that you're also writing something that, oh, nobody's going to know any of this, then the creative liberties are taken in ways that I think lose the essence of the thing itself. I think I was doing some research in some DC comic stuff, and I think of the Orishas, they made Obatala like the head, and one of the gods that serve under him was Olorun. And in the actual mythology, it's the other way around. Like, Olorun is the supreme being. So it's like saying the one above all answers to somebody in the Marvel Universe. It just doesn't work. It just doesn't make sense. The entire concept doesn't work. So and I can understand that mistake happening because Obatala is called the creator god. And in most mythologies, the creator god is usually on the top of the hierarchy. But this is the god that created the creator god. So I think there's more sensitivity now and with the way we address things, primarily because now when you write a story, you're like, oh, even when you're writing Thor, you're like, someone from Norway, from Sweden is going to be reading this. You know, when you're writing the Orishas, they're like, yeah, somebody in Brazil, someone in Nigeria will be reading this. And I think that's helps in how you represent these things. You know, as you can see, when it comes to, you know, the robot Rax, you know, the author here is mentions it like 4 to 5 times about, oh, this Rax is this. It feels like it's like, oh yeah, I found out this thing about Hindu, this that I really want to tell you guys, you know. So it doesn't feel like someone that feels like the audience is going to be someone that is in it and understands Hinduism and everything about. So, and I think that's why the approaches are different. That's why there isn't much effort to even just make the characters look cool. You see efforts to make Thor look cool, and then, you know, Shango has a guest appearance in an issue, and he's just wearing loincloth, and he's like, dude, like, it's because you are still writing for Thor fans. You don't imagine that there's a Shango fan reading this book. So it's just like, yeah, let's just put this guy here and just say, you know. So yeah,
for more on this, go listen to Marewa Dotun and I talk about M'Baku the Man Ape, right? Like, we can talk about how there's potential, but oh my goodness, nope, that's not a plan that should ever have been made. Now, I want to spend just a moment. Again, I opened the show this month with an incredible interview with Yvonne Chereau all about appropriation and voodooism. Marewa, we're going to talk, the trial at the end of the month is all about Brother Voodoo and Black Talon, who are characters that I've really grown to love, but oh my goodness, there's some stories along the way that should never have happened. For example, the supervillain dressed as a chicken, right? Like, that's not a choice that should ever have been made. But you've been using Brother Voodoo in Storm really lovely recently. Are you a big fan of this character? How did you learn about him? I'd love to hear some of your thoughts. And then Stephanie, same thing. Are you a fan of Brother Voodoo? If so, how and why?
I think I'm still using Dr. Voodoo now. Is the avatar of death right now because he's the necromancer. I'm not even sure how I discovered him. I think it's, you know, because I'm newer to comics, so sometimes when I discover things, it's mostly I'm just doing research and I'm like, oh, this looks cool. And then I go and read comics about the character. So finding out that this character with voodoo and his aesthetics are just really cool, you know, you have this juju vibes and everything. And then finding out and if you know voodoo, you know, it's linked to juju, which is linked to, you know, Yoruba mysticism. You know, there's elements of it like all mixed together with hoodoo, voodoo, everything. So, you know, getting to see some of those Yoruba things, especially in Rick Remender's solo story, that's Dr. Voodoo, Avenger of the Supernatural. And yeah, so that really got me excited. I think the villain that was supposed to be at the end of the story is Ogun, which is like the Yoruba god of war and metal. And you know, that's how I fell in love with the character. And yeah, I've been doing readings forward and back, and some of his, you know, appearances. And yeah, so he's the character I love. And you know, sometimes you see those stories, you're just like, just skip through it a little.
We're gonna record the trial and the history of Brother Voodoo, including that like brief section of history where he only speaks in Bendis magic, where like all of his spells are like Hagana Lini Mulalulu. Like it's so weird, but I love the character very much. Stephanie, do you have any thoughts on Brother Voodoo?
You know, surprisingly, no. My interactions with Brother Voodoo has really been anytime he popped up in Black Panther, which also tragically was not well done. And yeah, no, I really, other than, no, not too much with Brother Voodoo. And I think that, but I think more so, I think that's because it's a very complicated history, but I just know with hoodoo and voodoo, those are things that I don't want to play with in that sense, right? That was just a character that never actually really appealed to me, but not saying that I don't think he's a character that should exist, but one that I've been thinking about going back and just getting to know a little bit more, because yeah, Stanley, what was the thought behind that? Did you go to New Orleans one time and you said, you know what? New idea.
Well, I think someone saw the movie Sugar Hill one time and thought, let's do that as a character. That's what happened.
You know what? You're right.
It is such a tremendous honor to be hosting conversations like this. It just feels like the pinnacle of like, I don't know. I'm so pleased to like call both of you friends. I'm such an enormous fan. I get giddy every time I make this show. So thank you for your ongoing trust and support. And it's just such a joy to have you both here. We'll wrap up here. I know Stephanie is very anxious to get onto the SpongeBob SquarePants movie.
Oh my God. No, I'm going to do some voodoo hoodoo before I get there.
To do as parents, I understand. So where can people find you both online and anything you'd like to plug for February 2026?
Yeah, so online you can find me on Instagram, Threads, and also TikTok at Steph_I_Will, also Blue Sky, Stephanie Williams. For February, please check out I think it's Roots of Madness issue 5 will be out. Issue 4 will be out. Please check that out. It's a very beautiful cover that Julia NECA did where we see a young Black girl getting her scalp oiled on the cover. I don't think we've ever seen that before. Also, there is a Star Trek comic that I did that is very timely, and didn't pitch it for Black History Month, but it works. It stars Lieutenant Uhura. She goes back in time. If you are a fan of the OG Star Trek series, this is a deviation from the episode The City of Forever. So please check that out. And if you love some Wonder Woman and Nubia, I'm so sorry, I know this is Marvel, but if you love some Nubia and Wonder Woman and you finally want to see them fight together, then Wonder Woman 30 will be out and you get to see that. And we're dealing with gods in that too.
I do not work for Marvel. You can plug everything you like.
Okay. For February, Storm Earth's Mightiest Mutants issue 1 will be coming out. This beginning of a new arc in Storm's ongoing saga. And also in February is a little short story I did in the Black Panther 60th anniversary comic book, which also involves Storm and Black Panther. So yeah, those are the ones I know of that are coming out in February. And you can find me on Blue Sky, Threads, and Twitter at Ayodele Muriwa. And speaking of, you know, voodoo and hoodoo, you know, I write a lot about it. I do a lot of research. I watch videos and everything. The first time, you know, I found myself in kind of like somewhere close to like a shrine and, you know, seeing all those stuff. Yeah, I understand what Stephanie was saying. I got real scared, you know. So yeah, it can be scary. It's different in comic book and it's different when you see it in real life. You know, we all like to draw those skulls and different things. And if you see skulls in real life, you're like, what the, what, like, this is going to be me next, you know?
All right, everybody. Thank you so much for the ongoing ongoing support. I hope everything is going great by the time we get to February, but you know, chances are we got to still hunker down and take care of ourselves. So making this show remains a huge joy. Thank you everyone for listening. Follow the show, Gray Malkin underscore Lane, and on Instagram, and we'll see you all back here next week.
And now stay tuned for some thoughts on fascism as a special guest and I talk about a Red Skull story and its modern applications. There wasn't a single pre-written master plan for concentration camps sitting in a drawer years before Hitler took power. What existed before 1933 was a tradition of emergency detention in Germany that the Nazis could exploit once they gained control. During the Weimar Republic, short-term protective custody and detention without normal due process had precedence in moments of political crisis, and Nazi propaganda in the early 1930s increasingly framed communists and other opponents as existential threats requiring exceptional measures. But the decisive shift came after Hitler became chancellor on the 30th of January, 1933, when the regime quickly created legal and police conditions for mass detention, especially after the Reichstag fire, go look that up, and the ensuing emergency decree that crushed civil liberties. The first camp established by the Nazi regime was Dachau. It emerged in this chaotic, fast-moving early phase rather than the long-term construction project. The initiative is tied mostly to Heinrich Himmler, the Munich police president, who announced on the 20th of March 1933 that a concentration camp would be opened near Dachau. The camp began operations on March 22nd, 1933. So 2 days later, they were already constructing. Early on, it was intended primarily to imprison political opponents, communists, social democrats, trade unionists, outside normal courts, consolidating Nazi power in Bavaria and beyond. The initial concept was a coercive political instrument: remove opponents, terrorize networks, and demonstrate the regime's control. But as the SS took over and standardized the system, Dachau also became a model and a training site for expanding concentration camp networks. The land question was solved quickly because Dachau was not built from scratch on first. The camp was established on the site of a former munitions factory and related facilities near the town of Dachau outside Munich. This allowed rapid conversion into a guarded detention site with existing buildings and infrastructure. To the public, the regime did not describe it as a death camp or a permanent system of torture. It was presented as a place for protective custody and re-education wrapped in the language of restoring order and public safety. In other words, the Nazis sold it as a very necessary security measure against enemies of the state, even as it quickly became a place of brutal violence, humiliation, and unlawful imprisonment. Over time, Dachau expanded far beyond its initial role. It grew into a major camp and a wide prisoner population with an extensive network of sub-camps, especially during World War II, as forced labor became central to the Nazi war economy. Dachau was not originally designed as an extermination center like Auschwitz-Birkenau was, but death was endemic. Prisoners died from starvation, disease, torture, execution, and medical abuse. And yes, you're hearing me correctly, there were different kinds of concentration camps designed: work camps, death camps, and holding camps. The U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum estimates at least 40,000 people died at Dachau and its sub-camps, many more in other places. Secrecy was maintained through SS control, censorship, terror, and isolation. Prisoners were cut off, mail and information were restricted, and any leaks could bring lethal punishment. But it was also crucial to be precise. Dachau's existence was not fully secret. It was publicly announced in 1933, and while the scale of brutality, killing, and the camp system of true function about what the regime wanted to conceal, downplay, or euphemize during the war and its post-war denial. All right, that was a serious one. We're going to jump to Captain America, the 65th anniversary special. We're now a little few more years beyond 65 anniversary. Issue opens on April 1944. It's by Ed Brubaker with Javier Paludo, Marcus Martin, and the editor, or one of the editors on this book, is the inestimable Molly Laser, who's here with us today. In the city of Eisendorf on the border of Latveria and Austria, Captain America, Bucky, and the Howling Commandos are there to stop another Nazi plot. The Red Skull, in his black trench coat and swastika armband, flanked by swastika flags, yells at his soldiers to work harder, faster. Keep working, you lazy dogs. No rest until your replacements arrive. Under the coerced aid of a man named Hermann Dex, the Nazis dug into the ruins of the city, searching for an ancient robot. So this is after the concentration camp has been evacuated at this point. But they buried an ancient robot here that was sent by an alien civilization and buried beneath an ancient castle. The robot, who was one of the many sleepers to follow, was unearthed but quickly destroyed by the Allies. It was buried, and Captain America assumed Red Skull had been buried as well. He wasn't until later. But now we're in the present, tying into the Captain America Volume 5 storyline, where the Red Skull's in the body of Alexander Lucan, and they're preparing to awaken the Ancient Sleeper once again. This gets carried over into the main Cap title. Let me welcome my dear friend Molly Laser back to the show. Molly, hello. We have had some serious chats and some silly ones. I'm so happy you're here. Are you a Red Skull fan, my friend?
Yes. Yeah, I'm a Red Skull fan, especially, you know, reading and working on this Ed Brubaker run, what he did with Alexander Lucan being the sleeper agent for, like, having the Red Skull inside him. I just thought it was really cool. And the Captain America, the First Avenger with the Red Skull is probably my favorite MCU movie that's not Fantastic Four. And I have a soft spot for this wacko Nazi hero.
In that he's like the ultimate evil that you can punch in the face.
I mean, there's nothing redeeming about him. And he is what it is. He wears it on his face. So, like, he's just bad.
Oh, you and I've talked a lot of Fantastic Four lore on the show, which I love. But I don't know a lot about your history with Captain America. Do you want to talk about your relationship with the character and what it was like to edit this book and this title?
Yeah, sure. So I was not a Captain America fan until I started working at Marvel. And I came in at Marvel about 3 or 4 months before Avengers Disassembled and Brian Bendis is taking over New and then starting Mighty Avengers. And so I started getting to know Captain America there and immediately enjoyed the character. And then once Ed Brubaker started his run, I absolutely fell in love with Bucky.
Yeah, this is the Winter Soldier run where we break the rule. You can't resurrect Bucky.
And I remember Tom Brevoort had the thing, like the two people who must stay dead are Uncle Ben and Bucky, unless there's a really good story there. Ed had a really good story. And he was just such a wonderful writer to work with. And I loved working with Steve Epting and Mike Perkins on the run. And I think because of Ed's writing, I really like fell in love with the character. And I now have an unbroken run of Captain America comics dating from 2004 to the present. Mm. So I've continued reading the character and, you know, some storylines I have enjoyed more than others. And there were times where I was like, oh, I think maybe I'll stop reading the comic. But then a little voice in my head goes, unbroken run. I'm like, oh, fine. And then something will happen and I'll get interested again.
There's a lot of ways to tell a Captain America story. We've had a fair amount of Captain America chatter on the show over the years, just because he interfaces with the X-Men a lot. And I like to hit things from different angles. Do you have any memories of working on this book specifically that you'd like to share?
Like the 65th anniversary special?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I do not. But I really, really enjoy the Javier Pulido art and Marcos Martín. I just think their style is so, like, it's old-fashioned, but also modern. And I have the entire run of Daredevil that Marcos Martín did with Mark Waid, mostly for the Marcos Martín art. I really enjoy his style.
Yeah, both these artists have almost, I want to call it like a wholesome quality about it, but it's like very deep action. So when you see them go from like drama to action, but it's very Saturday morning cartoon, but also classic. I really enjoy both of them as well.
And one thing that I remember Ed making a point that like people tend to think of Bucky as Steve's teenage hero, but they were actually pretty close in age. Bucky's age comes up in this issue. He's like, I'm 19. He's not a kid. He's 19. I mean, yes, he's a kid, but he's 19. And Cap at this point's probably in his like early to mid 20s. So, like, they're not that far apart in age. And it also coming off that, like, Captain America has a shield, but Bucky's the one with the gun.
Although, you read those old 40s comics, and Bucky looks like he's about 11 and a half.
Yeah. But I think Ed figured it out, and he would have to have been older.
So, these ancient threats being unearthed by new regimes to attack the public are always uncomfortable stories. And we see Captain America and X-Men comics go over and over and over there. We've talked about the hate monger on my show, you and I. I opened with an interesting spin on the opening of Dachau. I think when we frame it as an internment camp for like political opponents, that's a very specific way of viewing things. And then you very quickly watch how it slid into something very, very dark after that. Did you have any thoughts on that opening? And we are very able to draw some modern parallels, obviously.
That's what I was going to say, was that, I've heard a lot, I mean, and this was, oh God, was this even like between 2016 and 2020? But you keep hearing, oh, well, what is our nation's Reichstag fire? And, oh, maybe this is it. Maybe this is it. Well, I mean, we're there. And the, like, everything you were saying just sounds like what's going on now, which is ab- absolutely horrifying, comparing to what's going on currently in Minnesota and the various detention camps.
Yeah, we're recording this, everyone, in mid-January. So we have had the Greenland announcement, we've had the Venezuela takeover, and we've had the armed killings and like gassings and beatings in Minnesota. The Reichstag fire, I have talked about on the show before, but for context, for those that may not have heard, there was a Nazi building called the Reichstag that was burned down in 1933, and it kind of turned public opinion toward Hitler, because they're like, oh, look at these evil things the communists are doing to like silence our voices. But it's very likely that the Nazis were involved in the fire itself. So like the January 6th, or like the presidential quote unquote assassination of Trump, or like these little things that like spin favor back toward the right, are like the equivalent of Reichstag fires. What event can we seize to turn public opinion toward us is a long-term strategy that we see the Trump government using a lot.
Or not even, and also like using this as the excuse of, oh, well, look at the other side of the woke left and like, look what they did. Now we're going to retaliate stronger. And that's, I guess there have been many instances like engineered probably.
Some of them quite fruitful for the far right and others. But I remember after Charlie Kirk was killed, which I was very involved in, not the killing, but like the aftermath and the therapy. There was a very quick turn in the government about labeling all trans people as a terror group, which when we look at how people can get politicized in a certain direction, it's very, very deeply uncomfortable. How are you doing in 2026, my friend? You are a mom, you are a liberal and a safe space for diverse people, and you're a teacher, which I know this is not an easy time.
Yeah, and when you talk about Charlie Kirk, so my students, we were in the middle of play rehearsal when we found out that Charlie Kirk was shot.
It was 20 miles from my house, Molly.
And my students, who were not supposed to be on their phone during play rehearsal, but you know, someone got shot and that's bad. And it was like these conflicting feelings about it. I don't know. I guess it surprised me to an extent how knowledgeable they were about, you know, people and like people, notable figures in politics.
Yeah. And it can surprise us also how deep our feelings run when we don't even realize it.
Yeah. And it's just, I don't know. I don't teach social studies and I'm really glad I don't teach social studies. However, it's been a really awful feeling all semester, because once every 3 years in my reading class, we do a unit on the Bill of Rights. And so I've been teaching, and for reference for folks listening, I teach reading to students with learning disabilities. And we've been talking in depth about First Amendment rights, Fourth Amendment rights, and Fifth and Sixth, so the rights of people who are on trial. And I feel like everything I'm saying is just total bullshit right now. And that's upsetting. Like, I'm trying to teach what our country is supposed to be, and it's very much not that now. So it's this like extreme cognitive dissonance.
Well, and it's even crazier too. And I won't use any names here, but I have a lot of friends that are teachers, both through the show and not. So I have a friend who's a queer teacher who cannot be out as queer at school, and they have banned all conversations about queerness and sex education, and even gay education or gay words from like the library books or conversations in class. This person also has to hang the Ten Commandments on the wall in their classroom. It's like a mandate in their state. I have another friend who's a history teacher who's like, I just taught the unit on fascism, but when students raise their hands and say, how does this compare to the modern times? I can't talk about it. I'm literally not allowed to, either in or out of class, because I would get sanctioned if even one kid spoke up. I think about you in theater. If you tried to put on like Cabaret right now, which is all about like the queer community right before the Nazis took over, like there's some wild things to consider in all of that.
Well, first of all, Cabaret came up as a possibility last year, that the musical, I don't do the musical at school, I only do the straight play, but it came up last year and I got asked for my input on whether or not we should do Cabaret. And my immediate response was no. And first of all, no, and also, why are you asking me? I have nothing to do with this production. And my reason was because I don't want Nazis on my stage. The principal's reason for rejecting it was because there's too much sex stuff.
Even The Sound of Music is full of Nazis. It's crazy.
Right. But so this year they're doing Chicago. So yeah, but I plan way ahead with the plays I direct. And 3 years from now, there's a play I would really like to do called The Visit, which is a German play that's kind of expressionistic, but it also has to do with like, it's not directly about Nazism, but it's like how easily public groupthink can happen and how easily people can be swayed to maybe a side of evil. And if and when that gets rejected, by the administration, my alternate choice is Rhinoceros by Eugene Ionesco. And the only reason you'd reject that is because you're a fascist.
Yeah.
If you, fascists.
If you want to put on cabaret, but you also can't talk about the threat that's behind the play, these are divisive and intense times that may get even crazier. It's crazy as a therapist, too, let me tell you. It shows up in all kinds of ways where what I'm allowed to say, but where I have to draw the lines, it's hate speech, can be very tricky. How you doing as a mom? These are crazy times to raise children. I have a queer kid and a straight kid, and it's painful.
Yeah. At the moment, my kids are kind of in a bubble for the most part. Like, we don't have a ton of ice activity around our area. There's some, but not a lot.
And yeah, my kids are very shielded as well. I am not, but they are, which I'm grateful for.
And they're in, you know, kind of like this bubble of being fourth graders. But like, we were at synagogue last Friday, and we say a prayer for, you know, people who have died, and we're celebrating the anniversary of their deaths at every service. And we name the people whose anniversary of their death that we are celebrating. And our rabbi mentioned Renee Nicole Good, and the boys were like, who's that? And I said, you know, not right now, because we're about to do the prayer, but I'll explain to you in the car. And so then I had to, you know, explain that to them. And like, so things crop up.
Yeah.
And
police killing a queer woman down the road from where they killed George Floyd. Just in, like, my brain cannot compute how horrible everyone is feeling. And you know, ICE, I don't see them marching up and down my street, but I have witnessed an ICE arrest here locally. And I know they've been in the streets here. And I have loved ones who have family members missing and they don't know where they are, which takes us back to the internment camp thing again. Political prisoners and people disappearing and not allowed any contact with the outside world. There's a reason we draw these comparisons. It's icky and ucky to like reckon with as it's happening around us.
And then I don't know where we go from here. Like, I don't. And that's where are we going to go in the next 3 years? And that's terrifying.
Our values and our commitments to creating a joyful world don't change. And that's something, you know, we've all had to sit with. I won't sit in dread, even though the dread is always there. Like, I'm determined to create joy and safety. And that's where I always land on this show, especially as we're doing pop culture analysis. You know, when I started 3 years ago, this was not my mission statement, but I'm going to keep speaking truth in this crazy world until I'm not able to. How are you keeping joy alive in your life?
Oh, the theater. It's the theater. I'm constantly working on planning for or directing a show. And I mean, I'm performing, we're rehearsing for a show right now. We're doing Sweeney Todd. It's extremely cathartic. There's a lot of murder. And then, you know, planning for the show in the fall. And I'm just kind of trying to.
Sweeney Todd in Chicago, both of them, like, when is murder okay?
I'm spending time with my kids and just trying to mold them into good people.
I have a bunch of episodes on my show coming out in March about like parody and gimmick. And one of the ones I was looking into the other day, I hope this makes you laugh, was like the history of Masterpiece Theater. And it's like this very fancy thing. And then you go to Sesame Street and it's like, welcome to Monsterpiece Theater. But just this morning, my husband and I were watching the newest episode of RuPaul's Drag Race. And they have a skit where it's like, welcome to Master Queef Theater. And I was like, oh, we've gone a very different direction with parody. All kinds of ways to speak truth. Do you have any kind of parting thoughts or words of wisdom for our listeners today?
Stay safe, find joy, surround yourself with good people.
I am so grateful for this community, for your friendship specifically. Thank you. We already have plans to hang out, everybody. Molly and I are going to be talking about vapor later this spring on the show, which I'm excited about. Well, thank you, my friend. Take care of yourselves, everyone. Live safely, live joyfully. My mantra these days is living joyfully is an act of defiance, and I am determined to do so. So create solace where you can. Thanks, Molly Laser.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll see everybody back here next week. Thank you for listening to Grey Malkin and Lane. We hope you are enjoying this podcast. Grey Malkin and Lane is produced and recorded in Salt Lake City, Utah, with music and editing done by my husband, Michael Bell, and promo art done by the incredible Seth Martell. Look for us on Patreon, where we are releasing weekly episodes about obscure characters and facts. It's a great way to participate with the podcast for only just a couple of dollars a month, and it helps support what we are doing here. Also, the best way you could help Grey Malkin Lane is by sharing and liking and subscribing, but also please leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. We'll see you back here next time.